Luke 8:40-8:56. The 38th talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 19, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, in studying through the Gospels, as we are, occasionally you're going to come across, let me step back for a second. When we stop to think about the primary function of the Gospels, John is the one who puts it most explicitly in his Gospel a couple of times, but he says that I write these things that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, and in believing you might have eternal life. So the Gospels are not written to bless us. The Gospels are written to convince us and to persuade us of the truth about this person, Jesus. Now, in the course of doing that, the Gospels record much of the teaching of Jesus, and we're coming out of a section where we've received quite a bit of teaching by Jesus, and Jesus, as you know, had quite a few good things to say, so there were blessings to be had in the teaching of Jesus. We're coming into a section of the Gospel now where Luke is just cataloging things that happened that in fact are evidence that ought to persuade us that this man is who he claimed to be, the Messiah. So I don't know that there's a lot of blessing to be had in the passage before us, but this happened. And the fact that it happened stands as a monument and as evidence that Jesus was this man sent from God into the world as the Son of Man and the Son of God to be King of Kings and Lord of Lords one day. So the blessing to be had is, this is real, this is true, he is the one with whom we have to do. So let's look at a couple of accounts here if we have time, next in the Gospel of Luke, starting with verse 40 of chapter 8. And I'm just going to go through a chunk at a time here and comment on it this morning. Now as Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they had all been waiting for him. And there came a man named Jairus, and he was the ruler of the synagogue. Then falling at Jesus' feet, he tried to persuade him to come to his house, for he had an only daughter, about 12 years old, and she was dying. Luke says, as Jesus returned, if you remember from last week, he's returning from a fairly spectacular, dramatic moment on the other side of the lake, which is Gentile territory, where he commanded the legions of demons to depart from this man who had been plagued by legions of demons. The Gentiles were so freaked by that, I would argue, that they wanted him to leave, so they ordered him to leave their land. So they just got back, he and the disciples got back on the boat and returned. And we're probably back at the northwest corner of the lake, the area called Gennesaret. But that's probably where he's come back to, although it doesn't say here. So he returns to Gennesaret from the land of the Gentiles, Decapolis. And there's a crowd of people who welcome him, and they've been actually waiting for his return. So they've evidently just been gathered there, hanging out in whatever way they could hang out, waiting for him to return. He returns, and there comes a particular man named Jairus, who Luke says was a ruler of the synagogue. Synagogues were organized in such a way that there were three, sometimes four people who would have been officials in the synagogue. I think they called him president. I don't remember, but there was a president of the synagogue. There was a Chorazim who was kind of a manager of the synagogue, and a couple of other officials. The word that's used here, I think, as best I can determine, is not specific as to which official he is. It's just he was one of the officials of the synagogue. So we don't know whether he was the head guy or one of the other three, but he was some sort of official in the synagogue. As an official in the synagogue, he would have been well known. He would have been that this was not a celebrity culture, but among the people in his community, he would have been better known than others, respected. You don't get to be an official of the synagogue without having the respect of the community. This man says has an only daughter. Now, what's not clear to me from the Greek, it's not clear whether this is his only daughter, but he has other children, sons, or whether this is his only child who happens to be a daughter. I would read the Greek that it was his only child, and this only child is a daughter. The daughter is about 12 years old, which in that culture would have been, if not marriageable age, on the verge of marriageable age. Typically 13, 14 was a typical age for their daughters to get married. So she's either a young woman or right on the verge of becoming a young woman in the eyes of their culture. But she's dying. Jairus, concerned about his daughter, knowing the report about Jesus, evidently believing that he had the authority that he claimed to have, knew that Jesus could heal her, so he goes and seeks Jesus out, wanting his help. If anyone can save her life, Jesus can. So he seeks Jesus out and comes to him. He falls at his feet and implores him to come to his home to visit his daughter, to heal her. Just on the side here, what struck me as I was reading this is, and by the way, this is my Father's Day message, is this father obviously has a great deal of love and concern for his daughter. It struck me as when you read academics who look back at ancient cultures and try to read the cultures, and they tell you all kinds of things about this is what was true in that culture and this other thing was true in that culture. We really need to take great caution. I mean, imagine people 1,000 years from now looking back on our literature, our news reports, our controversies, our problems, and so on, and making claims about American culture. I mean, the fact of the matter is our culture is deeply split. Our culture is fractured. Yes, there are some people who have horrendous attitudes toward women. So some men in our culture have horrendous, evil, horrific attitudes toward women in our culture. And you could find all kinds of evidence in our culture of that. On the other hand, you have other people who greatly respect the opposite sex on both sides, because they understand what the Bible teaches. They understand that we are all creatures made by God and that we are due equal respect. We are made equally in the image of God and so on. And out of that understanding, they have the appropriate respect, or at least are striving to have the appropriate respect due to that truth. Well, which represents our culture? Well, there are clearly two different cultures here. Granted, in the modern times when things are fractured and are more fragmented than they probably were at any time in history, granted you might find more homogeneity back in the ancient world than you do today, but nevertheless, human beings are human beings, and human society is human society, and within human society you're going to find a variety of attitudes, a variety of perspectives, and a variety of beliefs in any culture that you might confront. So I think we have to be very careful and understand that the scholars that they are, having read lots of books, nonetheless come to some really hasty conclusions and make some very rash comments about what was true in the past and what's true in history. The fact of the matter is, if you ask the question, what was the attitude toward women in Jewish culture at this time, you get mixed results. You get mixed evidence. In the Torah, there is a rabbi who had 7 daughters, and he taught all 7 daughters Torah. And he's commended by that in the Talmud, that he taught all of his daughters Torah. You could find other evidence in the Torah that anyone who teaches his daughter Torah is, and I don't remember the mean, nasty name given to him, but some mean, nasty name that's given to him. So what do you do with that? On the one hand, you see evidence of a respectful attitude toward women. On the other hand, you see an attitude of of ignorance and chauvinism toward women. Well, which represents the culture? I don't know. I don't know what prevailed, and I don't think any scholar could know without actually being there. But I think what we're confronting in this particular account is probably a man, whether out of conviction and out of some kind of wisdom and understanding, or and maybe because he was forced to this attitude by the circumstances that God put him in. His only child was a female. And when your only child is a female, then you have to confront questions that you may not have asked yourself if you had a bunch of sons around. You could brush the female aside and not give her any attention and not show her any respect and get to know her and get to love her and get to respect her as the way that one should. But God had put this man in a position where he didn't have that option. She was his only child. And his God-given parental instincts click in, and he begins to get to know her as the human creature that God created her to be, and in so doing, the respect and compassion and affection grew within her. Within him. So however he got there, we see a man, I think, who deeply loves his daughter and does not want to lose her. So he comes to Jesus, believing that Jesus can heal her. Okay, now we have an interlude starting with 42. Now as he went, the crowds were, he's now going to the house of Jairus. Now as he went, the crowds were pressing against him. Now a woman who had lived with a flow of blood for 12 years, who had spent her whole life substance on physicians, was unable to be healed by anyone. Coming up behind, she touched the fringe of his cloak, and immediately the flow of her blood was stopped. Okay, Luke has already set the scene for us. There are a whole crowd of people waiting for him when he gets off the boat. Jairus approaches him and asks him to come and see his daughter. So they have to make their way through the crowd. There's these great crowds jostling, pressing against him. So he's being touched right and left by all kinds of people as he runs into them. In that context, a particular woman who had, as Luke puts it, who had lived with a flow of blood for 12 years. Now, we don't have any more information. We don't exactly know what this medical condition might be. It's very doubtful that she's hemorrhaging, that there's a blood flow. She would have bled to death before the 12 years is up. That's not likely. So it's probably a continuing problem, either vaginal or rectal, perhaps. There are many different medical conditions that could create either symptom. But as Luke puts it, she had actually spent her whole substance, and what he means is her economic resources. She had impoverished herself seeking a medical solution to this problem, whatever it is, spending her money on physicians. And no one had been able to help her. No one had been able to cure her of this disease. So in her desperation, desperation on the one hand, but as we will see, some semblance of faith, some kind of faith, the woman decides that maybe Jesus has the power to heal me. For some reason, unlike the other people that Jesus has healed in the accounts up till now, instead of approaching Jesus directly and asking him, imploring him to heal her, she decides to do it indirectly. If only I can touch the fringe of his garment, then maybe I will be healed. The fringe of the garment is the Jews of the time, every male Jew, according to the law of Moses, this was in keeping with a commandment in the law of Moses, wore an outer garment that had four corners on it, and they were required by law to wear a little tassel on each corner of the garment that was connected to the garment by a blue cord. Don't know why blue. And the purpose of the, at least in the rabbinic, I don't remember if this is in the Mosaic Covenant or not, but at least in the rabbinic tradition, the purpose of those tassels was to remind remind the man that he was to obey Torah, to obey the commandments. It was a visual reminder. That's what this word that's called the fringe of the garment is referring to, is that little tassel on the corner of the outer garment. So, I mean, what's interesting about that is there's no way in the world that if all she does is touch the fringe of the garment that Jesus felt it. I mean, that was not physical contact of any significant sort. So when he says, "Who touched me?" and as he points out, I don't mean who made physical contact with me. I mean, who was it that was the source of power going out from me? That there was clearly no physical contact for him to even notice. So it was the miracle being performed that he in some visceral way felt. When she does this, immediately the flow of her blood was stopped. Probably she was in the middle of a symptom at the time, and that's why when it talks about immediately it stopping, that's why it was noticeable to her immediately. But presumably she's healed for the duration. Now, I don't know why she wanted to do this indirectly and quietly. There may have been, if it's a certain, depending upon what the symptom is, it may have been a symptom that would have made her ritually unclean perpetually by the law. And so she had become basically an outcast to society. She'd become on the fringes of the society. And we've seen that over and over again, the way in which Jesus reaches out to those who are marginalized. But it may be that she had been marginalized in Jewish culture because of her condition. She could be embarrassed and ashamed of her condition. She may just be shy. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why emotionally and psychologically it would have just been too daunting for her to approach Jesus directly. So she does the best she can, given her state of mind and her psychological, emotional condition. She does the best she can. She touches the fringe of his garment. It's really kind of an interesting metaphor, an interesting picture of the tentativeness with which we sometimes approach God or our Lord. She approaches as tentatively as you possibly could, and God responds. God responds positively as we go on. And Jesus said, "Who is the one who touched me?" And when they had all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the crowd is surrounding you and pressing in on you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, for I became aware of power going out from me." So as I mentioned, just he felt something viscerally when God performed the miracle that he performed to heal this woman. Did that always happen? Could be. It could be that when God in his power acted to heal someone through the touch of Jesus or the word of Jesus, that Jesus felt something. On the other hand, it certainly doesn't have to be. I mean, we're inclined to just accept it at face value because we're so accustomed to thinking of, because of all the fantasy and fiction that we read and enjoy, we're inclined to think of Jesus as some kind of X-Man who has special powers by which he does what he does. But hopefully it's become clear by now in our study that Jesus doesn't have any special powers. He has a unique authority that God has given him, but he doesn't have special powers. It is God who heals, not Jesus. Jesus gives the word, but God supplies the power and the miracle and the creative energy to undo the maladies of these people. So it doesn't require Jesus to be a conduit of power. God, who can say, "Let there be light," and there's light, can say, "Let that person be healed," and they will be healed. And Jesus doesn't have to channel any energy whatsoever. So this may be a unique event. This may be an event where the only reason that Jesus is allowed to viscerally feel power going through him is so that he knows that God has just performed a miracle and can react to it and respond to it. I'm speculating. I don't know. I wasn't Jesus. I didn't feel what he felt. But there's nothing about the relationship of Jesus to God that requires this to be routine in the miracles. Okay, he goes on. When the woman saw that she was not hidden, that is, that she was not anonymous, that she was not invisible in this event, when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling, and falling down before him, she declared in the presence of all the people the reason why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. So she's been found out, and having been found out, she gathers the courage to go before Jesus and explain what happened. And undoubtedly, part of the courage arises out of the fact that there's been a positive result here, and God has indeed healed her and responded to her need. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." Now, what are we talking about here? A lot of people in contemporary Christian culture would like to take this as a kind of proof and a kind of evidence that the way this works is the reason why anyone gets healed is because of their faith. And on the if you take this at, on the surface, it looks like it could be saying this, that Jesus is saying to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." Which would be, if that's what he meant, that's an incredibly odd thing for Jesus to be saying, that her faith has made her well. Jesus points out on every other occasion that it's God who makes people well, who are in need of healing. It's not their faith that is the source of the power. It's the sovereign God who's the source of any power that heals. So what is he saying then? "Daughter, your faith has made you well." Well, in the first place, I'm not sure she had a very significant faith here. We don't know. There's no way to know for sure. But certainly the way in which Luke paints a picture of this woman, this could easily be an act of desperation on her part, not an act of faith. She's been 12 years spending everything she had to physicians to get healed. She has nowhere else to go. She has no more money for any more physicians. The physicians haven't been able to help her anyway. Where's she going to go? And yet there's this man who's begun to heal a bunch of people around the land, and the report has gone out, and she knows of him. Why not? She's tried everything else. Why not try this? I expect that that's what's behind her action more than it is any kind of faith. And what I mean by faith is any sort of clear and accurate grasp of the truth about who Jesus is. So I think actually the opposite is probably the case than the way we are inclined to take this. God is not healing her because he's rewarding her for the strength of her faith. Quite to the contrary, God is healing her because he wants to foster a faith that isn't even really there yet. So why say, "Daughter, your faith has made you well"? Because it's a way to point out to her, it's a way of saying to her, "You need to believe in me." In other words, Jesus is interpreting the act of God, the act of his Father here. What Jesus is saying here is, "I understand why God healed you. God healed you in order that you might have the faith, because the bare minimum rudimentary seed of faith that led you to come to me to touch the fringe of my garment, God is saying to you, yes, go that way. Look to him. Believe in him. Believe that he is who he says he is." That God honored her action in order to say to her, "Go that direction." It's your faith that is being affirmed. That is, and it, by her faith being affirmed, it's the object of her faith that is being affirmed, not the substance and quality of her faith that is being affirmed, I think. It's God's way of saying, "Yes, Jesus is mine. Jesus is my son, as you have heard. And now you know it, because when you touch the fringe of his garment, asking the question in your own mind, will this heal me? Does he have the power to heal me?" God answered her by saying yes, and thereby gave her the evidence and the ground for her to have faith. That seems to me to be more likely what Jesus is doing, interpreting the purpose of God in this. So, daughter, your faith has made you well. Keep that faith. Go in peace. Okay, now, that having happened, while he was still speaking, someone came from the house of the synagogue official, remember him, Jairus, saying, "Your daughter has died. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." So the daughter was dying when Jairus came to seek, came to seek Jesus out. She was evidently right on the verge of death. In the time that it took him to find Jesus and begin to bring Jesus back, the daughter has died. Those who were there sent a messenger to say to Jairus, "It's too late. Your daughter's already died, so you don't need to trouble the teacher anymore." But Jesus responds. When Jesus heard this, he responded to him, "Do not fear, simply believe. She will indeed be made well." Now, again, is he saying to Jairus, if you will just think positively, good things will happen? If you just think really hard and intensely that your daughter is going to get well, will that make it happen? Some Bible teachers may be inclined to take it that way, but I think this is Jesus simply talking about his purpose and his intention. He's inviting Jairus to believe him, Jesus, when he says, I have the authority here, and I'm telling you, I'm going to bring her back from the dead. So don't fear, I'm going to bring her back from the dead. Believe me when I tell you that. I think that's the most straightforward way to take this. So then he goes on, when he came to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the father of the child and her mother. Now they were all weeping and lamenting over her. So he said, "Do not weep. She has not died. She is but sleeping." And they started laughing at him, knowing that she had died. It's not quite as clear in Luke's account, but in the Matthew account, which I think corresponds to this passage, we have flute players mentioned. And flute players being mentioned suggests that we're dealing with professional mourners here. In Israel at this time, there was a whole profession of usually women who knew the procedures of mourning and preparation for burial and burial, that you would hire to come in and do the dying process for the family if someone was dying. It included various symbolic actions of wailing and pulling your hair out and baring their breasts and playing the flute of some kind of dirge on the flute, various sorts of ceremonial symbolic actions that were a part of the mourning process. And then they would make sure that everything happened according to the culturally acceptable order of things as well. And they were hired to do that. So they're not, the professional mourners are not necessarily emotionally and psychologically committed to this. This is their job. The family would join in, of course, and would take their cues from the professional mourners and mourn with them on cue. So the ones that probably start laughing at him are these professional mourners who are there to do their job. They know a dead body when they see one. They think Jesus is being just ridiculous here. So they know she died, but Jesus said she has not died, but she is sleeping. It's true that being asleep is sometimes a term that's used as a euphemism for people who are dead, but it's more frequently used to mean sleeping, someone who's asleep. So in the distinction between she has not died, she is sleeping here, Jesus is clearly intending a distinction. He's not saying she's not died, she is dead. He's saying she's not died, she's unconscious in a manner akin to sleeping, but I'm going to waken her. Okay, then he took her by the hand and spoke, saying, "Child, arise." And her spirit returned, and immediately she raised up, and he gave orders for something to be given her to eat. Okay, her spirit returned. Here's a clear case of spirit being used not to denote the spirit of God, but the human spirit of a particular individual. It's her personhood returned to her. It had been gone. It had departed from her, but it was returned to her. So this is a very touching scene. Jesus reaching out and taking the hand of the daughter, saying, "Child, arise," and her rising up. Then he gave orders for something to be given her to eat. Don't know why. I mean, the God who's capable of bringing life out of death is capable of nourishing the stomach at the same time. Why he forgot that part, I don't know. probably, I'm just speculating here, but probably it's for the sake of the others who are witnessing this miracle. If you then go to the trouble of giving her something to eat, you are going to be faced with the evidence that this is our same old little daughter. It's not a ghost. It's not a spectral, you know, image of our daughter. This is a real, live, breathing, flesh and blood human being who eats and needs to eat. It's much the same as Jesus ate after his resurrection, not because he needed to eat, but in order to provide evidence that this really was a resurrection to a bodily existence. I suspect that something like that is behind this. Her parents were amazed, but he charged them to report what had happened to no one. Okay, this is troubling to a lot of people. When you go through the Gospels, Jesus will do a miracle, and one miracle he'll go, "Don't tell anybody. I don't want you telling anybody that this happened." And then the next day he'll perform a miracle, let's talk about the two miracles that we've just talked about. The man plagued by the legion of demons. He orders them away. The man wants to accompany Jesus, and Jesus says, "No, just go throughout the town and tell people what happened to you. Go proclaim it." And the next day, he performs a miracle and says, "Don't tell anybody." Why can't he make up his mind? Does he want people to know, or does he not want people to know? I mean, what's going on here? The only answer I can give, the only way I can understand this, is I think it depends on why he performed the miracles. In the case of the man that he ordered the demons to leave the man, it was part of Jesus' intent. It was part of his purpose. It was part of his strategy that this would be a sign that he was going to plant in the middle of the Gentile culture in Decapolis, that there's this man who's come to be, who has a unique authority from God. And he intended that to be a message that he was sending to that culture, to that group of people. There are other miracles that Jesus performs, and we know this explicitly, Luke says so at times, where it's out of compassion. You'll have phrases like, and having compassion upon them, he healed them. Or having compassion upon them, he did this or he did that. His purpose is purely love and compassion and mercy, not strategy. He's not doing this to give evidence. He's doing this because he loves them and wants their suffering to end, and God has given him permission to heal these particular people. When that's the case, Jesus puts a lid on it. Okay, I'm going to heal you, but this is not part of my program for announcing the presence of the Messiah in the world. So can you kind of keep quiet about this and not tell anybody? When it's part of his strategy to bit by bit let the message out at strategic places, at strategic times, that this is the Messiah coming to the world, then he invites them and, in fact, encourages them to go out and spread the word far and wide. So that's the only meaningful distinction that I can see between why he does one rather than the other. In this case, notice that he only brings Peter, John, James, the father, and the mother into the room, so there aren't even that many witnesses to this miracle. Other miracles, of course, I mean, he doesn't even have the option of telling them to be quiet. Hundreds of people, thousands of people saw it, and good luck. You know, he's not going to keep that quiet. But he only has a handful of people here who even knew what happened. And he's able to say to them, let's just keep this between you and me. This doesn't need to go out at this particular time any further. Now, why would he be concerned about that? Why the tactic? Why the strategy? Jesus, I think, is politically savvy enough to know that he's walking this tightrope between making the people of Galilee so excited that the Messiah has come that they begin to do something stupid. And namely, like gathering into gangs of people and trying to begin a rebellion against the Romans because their king has come. And their king having come, the prophecies say that he's going to defeat our enemies. So if he's not going to get around to it, let's get this thing started. There's the possibility that they would do something stupid that would bring the Romans down on them. And that's not Jesus' purpose. That's not his agenda. So he's trying to walk this tightrope between giving them enough information to confront them explicitly and directly and dramatically with the reality of who he is on the one hand, but not get them so excited and so crazy that they get themselves killed by the Romans on the other hand. I think that's why he's sort of meeting out the evidence, trying to read the times and try to keep the excitement to a low simmer rather than to a hard boil. Okay. If I go into the next section, you want to get out early? I don't know if I'll have time to do this whole next section, so maybe why don't we just have our discussion and we'll call it an early Father's Day.
I'm not sure if I quite tracked this. She is not dead, but is sleeping. A couple questions came up in my mind. Is she dead?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so.
Is he then minimizing or diminishing the miracle for a reason? Or is he making a comment about death? Because he does raise her from the dead, but yet he says she is not dead, but is sleeping and her spirit returns. So can you kind of elaborate on that, Dee?
Yeah, no, I think she is dead. I don't think Jesus is in any way trying to deny the deadness of her death. It goes back to what he said to Jairus. Do not fear, simply believe. She will indeed be made well. I think he's speaking to the issue of his intentions. That is, we're not dealing here with a dead corpse that we're going to have to bury and put in the ground because my intention is to bring her back to life. So though she is dead, that is, though she has lost consciousness and is not present to us as a person, I'm going to return her to presence as a person, and so it will be as if she were merely sleeping. I think that's what he's saying. But I don't think he's making a comment on her actual condition. The mourners know that she's dead. I mean, they were a lot closer to death than we are in our day and age, and there's no way that they were mistaken about her death. I mean, there's all the evidence in the world that she was actually dead. But I don't think Jesus is saying she's not. He's just saying she's not going to stay that way.
I mean, I just came from a funeral, and it was very, very Catholic. And it had a 3-day ritual, and I was trying to imagine Jesus showing up, and it would be the same kind of thing. It would be like, no, he's dead. So I'm trying to imagine this would have simply blown people away, I would think. They knew,
absolutely.
Technically. I mean, so do you have any opinion on why there isn't much of a response?
Well, there aren't that many people who know exactly what happened. I mean, that's partly why he can say, let's keep the lid on this. There's only the 6 people in the room. The mourners are probably outside. They're probably not even witnesses to this. So as far as they're concerned, Jesus says she has not died, but she is but sleeping. And she comes walking out with them, and they go, oh, okay, I guess she was just sleeping. But, I mean, no one is trying to clarify exactly what happened in there. He wants to keep it quiet instead.
I was just thinking about, is it Jairus?
Jairus.
Jairus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if his daughter was kind of on the precipice of death, presumably there was a period of time before that where he was probably trying the physician tact as well. And so by the time he's, and being kind of a synagogue official, I mean, they kind of looked down on Jesus, didn't they, as kind of not...
Not all of them.
Not all of them?
No. A synagogue official was not necessarily a Pharisee. May have been, but not necessarily. And certainly were not connected with the temple and the priesthood. So although they were local leaders, they would have been the kind of grassroots people who were much more favorable and responsive to Jesus than the leadership. So he wouldn't have had the... he's not a part of the establishment that has a vested interest in offing Jesus, like the ones in Jerusalem.
Okay. So that may blow holes in my scenario. I'm trying to kind of get into Jairus' head a little bit, and I'm thinking, if he's kind of at a point of desperation to have his daughter healed, if he knows his daughter's kind of on the edge of death, and on the way, I mean, if Jesus was a last resort for him, and if the woman with the hemorrhage, who had been hemorrhaging for 12 years, and was ritualistically unclean, he may have known that, may have known her. And for Jesus then to have delayed his mission to care about this guy's daughter, to care about this woman whom he may be viewed as less than himself, less important. And then the embarrassment of Jesus kind of casting out the mourners. I mean, and then kind of having a private time with this guy. I mean, if I were Jairus, I mean, that would really kind of change the way I thought about God and the way I thought about my own importance. Makes sense? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Why is he even responding to his request? Is it because he's important, that he's an important official? And I hadn't actually noticed that, but you make a good point, is that he's not any more important than this woman who's clearly an outcast. So, yeah, it's not because he's important. Jesus just simply isn't a respecter of persons. He's not impressed with people's status. So I imagine there's a number of things throughout this whole event that are kind of confronting him with the reality that he's no better than anybody else. Is that what you're...
There seems to be a lot going on here in the last of chapter 8. Jesus is shown to have power over, you know, the wind, the waves, demons,
death,
health. I mean, it's really big stuff here.
Yeah.
But when he went into the Gentiles in the Decapolis, he was asked to leave because they got scared. Go away. You know, you're ruining our herds of swine and you're just scaring us. Just be gone. So then he comes back to the Jews. And they welcome him. And he does these great things among the Jews. That I have two questions on that. One is, he goes to the Gentiles and he gets rejected. He comes to the Jews and he's welcome, which is not the typical picture we see. I'm just kind of wondering, what's Luke doing with that? And the other thing is, when this woman reveals that had touched his robe, says, oh, by the way, the reason I did that and what you've healed me of is something that made me ritually unclean. I mean, no one in the audience may have known this until she revealed it. So now they look to Jesus and going, oops, does that make you ritually unclean? Then he goes in and he holds the hand of a dead person, also against the law.
It's true.
Again, ritually unclean. So is his coming back into the Jews, is part of what's going on here got something to do with his relationship to the law and their relationship to the law? Because he's volunteering. He's allowing himself, and he's volunteering to just say, ritual uncleanness compared to raising a child from the dead, who really cares?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Pharisees gave him trouble. You know, they gave him grief for healing on the Sabbath. So what are those two things, two dynamics?
Well, certainly that's going on, is that he's quite willing to put human life as a priority over his own ritual standing. What we don't know, which I would love to know, somebody asked me about this the other day, and Luke doesn't tell us, did he go and go through the rituals to be clean after every one of these miracles? I think by all rights he would have and should have. And maybe he did. I mean, I don't know that we have any reason to know that he didn't. But Luke doesn't go out of his way to tell us that. So I don't know. Is he somehow disregarding the law? Or was he meticulous in observing the law at the same time that he understood the law and its real purpose and its real intent? Either seem possible to me. I just don't know. But clearly he would have stood out from the Pharisees, because the Pharisees' perspective was ritual cleanness was so important that you wouldn't dare violate that in order to show mercy to another human being, whereas Jesus is quite ready to allow himself to be made ritually unclean in order to show compassion and love for another human being. So there's clearly a difference between Jesus' attitude and the Pharisees in that regard.
Hello.
Hi.
Happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm a little confused because we're talking about Jesus doing miracles, and then I heard you say Jesus doesn't heal, but God does. So I'm like a little confused on, you know, what, you know, if Jesus doesn't heal and God does, then what makes healing different than the other miracles? I'm sort of thrown.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't think Jesus does any miracles. It's God who does all of them. But God does those miracles in a way that they become strictly correlated with Jesus' person and his name. It's Jesus who has the authority to command the winds and the waves, to command the demons to depart, to command a person to come back to life. Jesus has the authority to command, but he doesn't have the power to do. It's only his Father, God, who has the power to do.
Okay, so then I get the image of God's this little runaround guy who, you know, does what Jesus says.
Wait, say that again?
I get the image, when I hear that, I get the image that God's this little runaround servant guy who does what Jesus says, and it's like, wait a minute, I can't think of God like that.
Right.
I don't know what to do with it.
Right, no, and that's not what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
It's not that God is subject to the word and command of Jesus. It's that Jesus is obedient to the purposes and will of God. But in his obedience to the purposes of will and God of God on earth, he has the ability to speak to nature, to people, to demons, and God acts. Now, God is not doing what Jesus wants. Jesus is doing what God wants. And that leaves the question, how does Jesus know what God wants? And I actually addressed that several weeks ago. It seems to me that actually it probably comes in two forms. There are times when Jesus knows that God has, in effect, given him discretion to do what he wants. And so that God has said, if you want to heal him, I'll heal him. And so that Jesus can use his discretion. And that's why he can do something out of compassion. That's why when he has compassion towards someone, he can just decide, I want them well. And God honors that. But God doesn't honor that because he's subject to the will of Jesus. He has already given Jesus permission. Use your discretion here. I'll do what you want. And then there are other times, I think, where God must specifically instruct Jesus and say, here's what I'm going to do. Go tell him.
Okay. Thank you. That gets more supernaturalness back into the picture of God for me, so I appreciate it.
Yeah. God is clearly the bigger of the two, and we mustn't lose sight of that.
This is a question out of curiosity than anything else, and it has to do with the event where he felt power going out of him.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other event where that you can think of that Jesus is blindsided by the force going through him?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm just rummaging through my memory, but I don't remember anything.
Okay, then if we take this one, I'm wondering if, as the disciples healed, what I'm trying to find out or what I'm curious about is this a testimony to deity, his own deity, and when I'm thinking about
No, it's not. No, all the miracles that Jesus performed are signs of his messiahship, not his deity. Because there isn't anything that Jesus did that was not one way or another replicated by an apostle or a prophet. Even bringing people back from the dead. Paul brought Eutychus back from the dead. Who was that prophet? Elijah brought the son of a widow back from the dead, wasn't it? So if it's proof of deity, then there's a lot of gods, a lot of incarnations walking around.
So do you think that Elijah and Paul and the other apostles that brought people back from the dead or did miracles, healings, and things like that, do you think that they would have this "I felt power come through me" experience?
Possibly, if in fact that was common. I mean, if in fact God consistently did that, but as I suggested, that may have been unique to this particular case. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all if that was not routinely the case. It wouldn't surprise me at all if routinely there was no visceral experience by Jesus. He just said, "Let it be," and it was, and he didn't feel nothing. Now, I don't know, but there's nothing about Jesus' relationship to God that requires that. You know, we're not dealing with sci-fi physics here, where there's an energy force that needs to flow through Jesus in order to make something happen. There doesn't have to be an energy force. There can be, if God wants there to be, but there doesn't have to be in order for his will to be done. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm going to turn it up a notch.
Okay.
Because you hear a statement in our culture saying that Jesus was 100% man and 100% God.
Uh-huh.
Often. That's explained to people how Jesus is as a human being. But I've also heard teaching about, like, for instance, the temptations when Satan tempts Jesus that he was going there with nothing more than. Am I wrong to take it that some of the interpretation of that teaching is he's going there with nothing more than anybody else would, but he was just perfect in his obedience?
Right. Yes, I think that's right. I think it's misleading. I mean, I understand what they're trying to say, and I don't have any problem with people saying Jesus was 100% God and 100% man, but I think it's misleading. It's better to think of Jesus and to understand Jesus as 100% certified human being who is God. And it's not God having become a man. That's the king of Babylon, who's the son of Marduk, who's that. It's not that it's God who's become human in form. It's a human being is what we're dealing with. A fully, truly flesh and blood certified human being. But this human being is uniquely God. Now, in what sense? Well, that's what you have to wrestle with and that's what you have to struggle with. But that's the testimony of the Bible. To say that he's 100% human being and 100% God forces you ultimately to decide that the guy is bifurcated. And then you try to interpret his life as, okay, is that his humanity showing or is that his deity showing? And you end up with this God-man monstrosity who some things acts as a man and sometimes acts as God. Unfortunately, I think that's the most typical way that we've been, you know, kind of instructed to think about him. But we won't understand what he's doing if we understand it that way. Think first, this is a human being. And then let the evidence come to show you this is a unique human being. And ultimately, to come to the conclusion, his uniqueness rises to the level that this man was God become flesh. This man was the visible image of the invisible God, and in that sense is God himself. That's how I understand it. Okay, I need to let you go. Not early, but on time.